Hello, this is Fiona Mullen of Sapienza Economics, and this is another episode of Figure It. This week, I'm taking a break from the energy series to discuss some little-known facts about UNFACYP, the UN peacekeeping mission in Cyprus, which commemorated its 60th anniversary on the 3rd of March. So we've heard a lot about UNFACYP in the past few days, but for me, one of the most interesting facts came from James Kerlinsey, who did his entire PhD on the establishment of UNFACYP and the run-up to it. So I thought I'd invite him onto the programme. Welcome, James, and of course, welcome back to Cyprus.
Hi, Fiona. Great to be with you and great to be back on island.
Yes. So James is visiting professor at the University of Kent and research associate at LSE. He's recently moved back to Cyprus, as we said, so he's on the island again. He's also the producer, if you're interested, of the incredibly informative YouTube channel called Prof. James Kerlinsey. It gives you a really well-researched, balanced, potted background on every single conflict you can think of in the world, every single place where there's a breakaway entity and so on. And it's also bang up to date, so really useful for foreign ministries, international institutions, think tanks, and of course, if you're a student of international relations. It's really well-researched, and I think what I really like about it, because it's very hard to do, is it's very balanced as well. So just to give you an idea of recent videos, one of them covered Bashkortostan, if you've ever heard of that. Pakistan, Iran, North Korea, Romania, Moldova, the US and its future relations with NATO, and of course several on Ukraine, Israel, Gaza and so on. It's really, really great resource. But let's get back to the beginning of your career, when you ended up picking Cyprus for your PhD thesis. You'd already spent a lot of time here, of course, because of your family. But how did you end up picking up UNFACYP as your core subject?
Well, thanks again, Fiona, for a very kind invitation and for the warm words about the channel as well. So, yeah, it was actually a bit of an accidental subject in many ways. So I originally wanted to look at what's called command and control in peacekeeping operations. And I'd been living here in Cyprus and had some familiarity with UNFACYP. And so started writing this. And, you know, in any PhD, you've got what's called service chapters, which are background chapters. And for this one, I was just going to write a background chapter on how the UN force got here to Cyprus. But as I started writing it, it was just at the time. So in Britain, most government documents are held under lock and key for 30 years. You know, sometimes it can be longer if it's particularly sensitive or indefinite if it's really sensitive stuff. But usually it's 30 years. And so this sort of rather dates me now. But this was, I started doing my PhD when they just released all the 30-year rule papers on Cyprus crisis 1963-64. Wow. And so it was just this opportunity to look into this absolutely fascinating story that tended to get glossed over. I mean, most accounts would just write a paragraph on what had happened, but didn't go into detail. And the other thing which was amazing, of course, at that time was that it was a time when many of the protagonists were still alive.
Yeah.
So suddenly I had all these British government documents, but also had the opportunity to interview people like Spiros Kyprianou, Tassos Papadopoulos, Ralph Denktash, somebody called Osman Orek, who many people have don't know about or has been forgotten about. And he was actually the first Minister of Defense of the Republic. So remembering when Cyprus became independent, you had the 10 ministers, three had to be Turkish Cypriots, and one of the key roles had to be given. And so it was an amazing opportunity to use all these resources. And so instead of writing this history, you know, this account of command and control, I ended up writing this history of how the UN force actually got here, you know, which at the moment, again, every 10 years, I suddenly find that, you know, I get a chance to talk about this PhD.
And just for people who might not know, Ralph Denktash was, of course, the Turkish Cypriot leader for many, many years. Kucuk, did you say you interviewed him as well? He was the first vice president, first and only vice president.
No, the two characters that I never got to meet were Makares and Kucuk.
Because they were already gone from this earth. Anyway, so let's run us through the various efforts at peace before we got to, okay, we better have UNFACYP then.
So, yeah, so as a potted history, I mean, obviously a lot of this will be very familiar to listeners. But of course, you know, Cyprus became independent in 1960. This new constitution that was going to allow an independent state to emerge, where power was shared between the Greek and Turkish Cypriots. But what we saw is that rather quickly, tensions started to emerge. And there were all sorts of reasons for it. You know, many Turkish Cypriots, by and large, were actually okay with the arrangements that emerged in 1960. But there were obviously opponents to it who'd wanted to see the island divided. Equally, on the Greek Cypriot side, many people had fought not for independence, but for Enosis, for Cyprus to join with Greece. And so you started to see tensions emerge in the operation of the new country. And there were a number of areas. So, for example, you know, on the military, how you divide up units within the Cyprus army, remembering Cyprus actually had an army at first, not a National Guard. That came later. How you would divide power in municipalities. You know, there were a range of these issues, and it all came to a head in 1963. And Archbishop Makarios, the first president, proposed a series of constitutional changes, and Turkey immediately rejected these. And what we saw in December 1963 is that fighting started to break out. It started in Nicosia and then started to spread to some of the other cities and villages around the island. Right. And that was essentially when there was the first effort, initially by Britain, to try and calm the situation down. So the original plan was they put in what's called the Joint Truce Force, which is an element of Cyprus peacekeeping, which really has been forgotten, which, as the name suggests, was a joint effort by Britain, Greece and Turkey to try and keep the peace on the island. But unfortunately, Greece and Turkey, the Greek and Turkish contingents on the island under the terms of the 1960 constitution, were effectively already taking sides with their ethnic kin. And so it was essentially left to Britain to try and manage the peacekeeping. And very quickly it found that it couldn't manage on its own. And so started to then look at ways to expand the force. There was actually a peace conference that was held in London in January 1964, but that obviously didn't produce the breakthrough that everyone had hoped for. And so Britain started to get a bit desperate, which then becomes the next stage in the story of when, you know, it started to explore the idea of a NATO peacekeeping force to replace it.
And before we get to the details of the various things that were tried, there's one big question which is still relevant today, and it's relevant to how we ended up with, or it's relevant to how UNFACYT was created, is one of the most contentious questions on the Cyprus problem is whether the Turkish Cypriots left government or whether they were pushed. This is a question that you ask in one of your many books, which is called The Cyprus Problem, What Everyone Needs to Know. It's only about 100 and something pages, very easy read. So yeah, it's a difficult question, so how diplomatically reply to that one.
Well, you know, you're right. It's such an important question. It remains a point of contention between the two communities, even to this day. I mean, you know, the Greek Cypriots say, well, the Turkish Cypriots left. The Turkish Cypriots say, well, no, we were kicked out. I mean, as is often the case in these sorts of situations, the truth lies somewhere in between. So it was very clearly the case that there were areas where Turkish Cypriots still wanted to continue coming into government offices and were prevented from doing so by Greek Cypriots. But there were also quite clearly orders that went out from Turkish Cypriot hardliners telling those who still wanted to cooperate with the Greek Cypriots that they weren't to. And it was actually quite interesting. I mean, you know, you have some Turkish Cypriots who sort of say that this isn't really the truth, that it was all about the Greek Cypriots. But, you know, what was very interesting is that actually several high-ranking Turkish Cypriot figures, I think including the deputy chief of police, were actually put on trial by Turkish Cypriot authorities for collaboration with the Greek Cypriots when they'd been told that they weren't to cooperate. So, you know, it really is a mixed picture, but it's obviously incredibly important, you know, because even to this day, there is this debate about whether the Turkish Cypriots voluntarily left or whether they were kicked out. And again, it sort of falls, it's a bit of both. And in some places, actually, the cooperation continued, you know, a few weeks longer after the violence erupted. But, you know, we can say certainly by mid to end of January, unfortunately, the first constitutional order had effectively broken down.
Yeah. So we have a breakdown of the power sharing arrangements in the 1960 constitution, which is still technically in force today. We have people being killed. What happened next?
So, as I said, I mean, you know, Britain had taken on this role. And to be fair, I think it was doing it very well. I mean, you know, you have to remember that, you know, when Cyprus erupted in 64, it was still very early days for the whole concept of peacekeeping. You know, so we now think of the UN as being the archetypical peacekeepers and have developed this idea. But it was actually a very new thing for the UN, even at that stage. You know, it's not written into the UN Charter anywhere. You can search the entire UN Charter for the word peacekeeping. You won't find it. You know, the initial plan was to have much more like enforcement operations, but there was only one of those really, which was Korea in the 1950s. Instead, peacekeeping emerged as this new form of managing conflict. And essentially in those areas where the Cold War had the potential to impinge on a situation where neither of the superpowers really wanted the Cold War to become a factor. So what you saw in Cyprus was that Britain undertook this role, but was very keen to try and bring in other actors to help it out. And the first attention really went to NATO. So Britain started to sound out other NATO members, but Archbishop Makarios was really opposed to this. And in actual fact, very interestingly, of course, Greece and Turkey were NATO members, and there was the expectation that Cyprus would probably have joined NATO. But I often say it was the one thing that the Greek Cypriots and Turkey always agreed on was not having Cyprus in NATO, partly because they both thought that NATO would favour the other. So for Turkey, the thought was, if we need to act, NATO will stop us from doing so if Cyprus is a member. And the Greek Cypriots said, well, Turkey is such an important NATO member, it's the only non-Arctic route into the Soviet Union, that NATO will automatically take Turkey's side if anything happens.
Is this how Makarios got his nickname of the Red Bishop from either the Americans or the Brits? I can't remember. Because he was against NATO, or?
Well, actually, that contributed to it, but it actually started earlier than that. It started in the 1950s, and Cyprus, having decided not to join NATO, actually became a stalwart of the non-aligned movement, which many people felt was actually sort of effectively pro-Soviet.
Yeah.
I think it's very simplistic to say that, you know, Makarios was pro-Soviet. You know, I think he was very adept at sort of recognizing that he could be squeezed within NATO and using whatever he could to stop that from happening. And so, yes, I mean, you know, his immediate reaction then, having made sure that Cyprus didn't become a member of NATO along with Turkey, stopping Cyprus from becoming, was that when this idea of a NATO peacekeeping force or a force made up of NATO member states was put on the table, he immediately pushed back on it, to the point that he actually wrote to Nikita Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, saying, look, this is what's happening. Will you do something about it? And Khrushchev then wrote to Britain, Greece and Turkey saying, no, we fundamentally oppose this idea of a NATO force in Cyprus.
Right. So then they had to think of something else.
Precisely, but not immediately. So I think at that point, Britain said, right, okay, game's up. You know, let's look at other options. But the Americans at this point, who'd been, you know, a little bit more detached, and remembering, of course, when Cyprus kicked off, it was very soon after the assassination of John F. Kennedy. So America was very much at that time, it was in a period of crisis, mourning. And it was a very, very difficult time in the Cold War as well. But once they started to become aware of the importance of Cyprus and what was going on here, they tried to continue to push the idea of some sort of NATO force. Britain by that point was saying, well, what about Commonwealth? But again, that didn't go terribly far for all sorts of reasons. But the Americans actually sent a mission under a very eminent US diplomat called George Ball to try and persuade Makarios to sort of look at this option. And it just didn't work. So, you know, by the middle of February, so 2 months into the crisis, Britain said, right, okay, game's up. Let's refer this over to the United Nations and see what can be done there.
And if I'm not mistaken, is UNFSCIP the first peacekeeping mission of the UN? Or
no, there were. So there are several different types of UN peacekeeping mission. So in fact, the first ones are what we call the observation mission. So you've got UNMUJIP, for example, which is on the line between India and Pakistan, which still remains in force. But the first major UN peacekeeping mission of the type that we now know as sort of the big military contingents was actually something called the United Nations Emergency Force, UNEF, which was put in place in 1956 in just south of Cyprus, in the Sinai. at the time of the Suez Crisis. So after Britain and France decided to sort of stitch up Egypt and persuade Israel to invade so that they could then step in as peacekeepers. And that whole ruse was revealed to the outside world. And America was absolutely furious about this, by the way. Mm. And it wasn't as pro-Israel at that point. So then the UN came in, and very much led actually by a Canadian initiative. So, you know, it's often said the father of peacekeeping is someone called Lester B. Pearson. And so that was the first UN peacekeeping mission. But UNFACYP, and then there was ONUC as well, which was in Congo, which was a whole brutal and very bloody history, period of history in the UN. So Cyprus was probably about the third of the major missions.
Right.
But it's the longest lasting now. UNFACYP is, having just celebrated its 60th anniversary, is by quite some stretch the longest surviving mission.
So then we finally have this agreement, thanks indirectly to a kind of Russian veto, which I think is interesting. We get to the resolution. So tell us a bit about that and why it's an issue for Turkish Cypriots and so on.
Yeah, so as you said, I mean, eventually we got to the position where it was Resolution 186, which effectively did two things. First of all, it put in a UN peacekeeping mission, UNFACYP, as we know it today, and the first troops started arriving about 3 weeks later. The second thing it did...
Just to interrupt you, right from the beginning, they didn't have, let's say, enforcing powers. They were just... They couldn't shoot, let's say, right?
No, I mean, a fundamental principle of any UN peacekeeping mission is, three principles, is non-enforcement, impartiality and consent. They have to be there with the permission of the parties. They have to be studiously neutral in how they approach it. And yes, they can't use weapons. There are very, very limited conditions under when they can potentially use, and they only come in with light weapons, so rifles or handguns, but not obviously any heavy material. So that's absolutely very, very strict rule. So so that was the start of UNFACYP. The second thing that the resolution did was create a peacemaking function for the UN. And we think of it today as the mission of good offices, but in actual fact the original intent was to have a formal mediator that was passed to a Finnish diplomat. But for all sorts of reasons, that eventually collapsed, maybe for another discussion another day. And then later in the 1960s, we had the mission of good offices that emerged, which sort of has a mediating function, but it's a little bit more ambiguous than that. But certainly the first initial idea was, that there was a formal mediator who was going in and to try and sort out some sort of political settlement. So UNFACYP and the mediator were put in place. Resolution 186 was really important, but it's always been a bone of contention for the Turkish Cypriots for one very key reason, which is that Resolution 186 effectively recognised the Greek Cypriots as having control over the government of the Republic.
Yeah.
And the Turkish Cypriots have always said that this, was unfair, that it wasn't right, that it cut them out of the picture. But one of the interesting elements in all of this is that...
Yeah, because just to interrupt you, even this week, the Turkish Cypriot leader Ersin Tatar, as everyone was commemorating UNFACYP, went out and criticised the resolution that established UNFACYP. And generally, under Tatar, the Turkish Cypriots have been giving UNFACYP quite a hard time, talking about trying to boot them out and so on. So, so they didn't like it, but...
Yes, they've never really accepted the authority of UNFACYP in that way. I mean, as far as the Turkish Cypriots are concerned, it's the Turkish army that does the peacekeeping for them. I mean, that sort of emerges from post-1974 more than 64, because, of course, the other thing to remember is that the Green Line as we know it today, although the term Green Line emerged in 64 with the line in Nicosia dividing the communities... The island-wide one was obviously post-1974. What we saw between 1964 and 74 was a very different type of peacekeeping mission, which we can think of more like a patchwork quilt. So different countries came in and had that initial, and they were given sectors across the island. So you'd actually have UN peacekeepers down in Paphos, for example, where there was still a large number of Turkish Cypriot communities and villages down there. So it was very different. But for the Turkish Cypriots, the key thing was that Resolution 186 recognised effectively the Greek Cypriots as having control of the government of Cyprus. But what's actually really interesting in it is that the Turkish Cypriots complained to Turkey at the time and said, look, this resolution is going to be really bad news for us if it goes through. And Turkey said, look, we need it to go through. We'll sort it out afterwards. Just don't kick up a fuss at this stage. And of course, that, as they argue, has never happened. And so, yes, there is a certain amount of, to put it mildly, grievance about what Resolution 186 said. But, you know, it really was a will of the international community at that point to try and draw a line under what was happening and make it sort of peaceful.
And it's one of the reasons why the good offices ends up coming in as an important actor. I used to work as a staffer for a short while at the good offices and have also been a consultant for much longer. But there's definitely a difference for the Turkish Cypriots between, am I dealing with UNFACYP or am I dealing with the good offices? I won't go into details, but it's quite clear that there's a distinction.
Yes. I mean, they effectively come from the same resolution.
Like some people say, you might one day UNFACYP might withdraw, but you wouldn't get rid of the good offices. And some people say the other way around, so it's difficult to know.
Well, you start getting into all sorts of very weird and wonderful technicalities because the legal basis for the mission of good offices, you know, do you draw a direct line from Resolution 186 or does it come in under some sort of different mechanism? I mean, I would tend to say that it's under Resolution 186, which put in place a mediating mission, albeit a very changed one. But, you know, this is one for the lawyers to argue.
Yes, yeah. Okay, we've hit our 20 minutes, so we won't talk about the future of UNFACYP, maybe some other time. But thanks for coming onto the programme, and we'll no doubt keep up our private talks about all of this stuff. Thank you.
Well, thanks so much, Fiona. Lovely to join you, and really great to be revisiting this topic.
So to finish up, Figure It is brought to you by Island Talks. It's the only trilingual podcast station in Cyprus. And if you want to help to pay for the overheads, go to islandtalks.fm and select Support Us, where you'll be led to, I think, Patreon, if I remember correctly. Okay, thanks, James.
Thank you very much again.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus, Island Talks. Open, diverse, free.